shows to what an extent we have sunk in the eyes of God. Now, you notice that this is something that is always promoted by those who like to call themselves liberal. And that also is taken up in the Bible. In the 32nd chapter of Isaiah, he starts out talking about what it's going to be like in the kingdom of God when all our present troubles are done away with and we're living under the reign of God. And in Isaiah 32, verse 5, he says that then the vile, V-I-L-E, the vile person shall no more be called liberal. He knew his liberals. Now as to foreign policy. You hear stupid people always parroting, oh, you must love your enemies. You remember the Bible is very careful to say your enemy and to distinguish between your enemy and God's enemy. If your fellow Israelite is your enemy, he's your enemy for one of two reasons. Either you actually have done something wrong to him, in which case you should make amends, or he mistakenly thinks you have done something wrong to him, in which case you should try to get him to understand that you didn't do it. But now God's enemy is a very different thing. You remember that on the breakup of Israel, on the death of Solomon, the northern kingdom went into idolatry immediately. And, of course, God naturally took away his favor from the northern kingdom of Israel on that account. A little while after that, one of the kings of Judah, who was making a half-hearted attempt to be good, sent military aid to help the king of Israel in some battle or other. And he was given this rebuke. Shouldest thou help the ungodly and love them that hate the Lord? Therefore is wrath upon thee from before the Lord. When you help God's enemies, when you range yourself on their side, you yourself become the enemy of God and can expect to pay the penalty accordingly. And parroting, love your enemy, isn't going to change the facts a bit. You don't fool God with catchphrases. In Psalm 139, King David says this, do not I hate them, O Lord, that hate thee? Am not I grieved with those that rise up against thee? I hate them with a perfect hatred. I count them mine enemies. Now, did God look down his nose at David and say, oh, why, you're one of those awful hate mongers? No. Two places in the Bible, Acts 13, verse 22, 1 Samuel 13, verse 14, you find God said this, I have found David, the son of Jesse, a man after mine own heart. If any of us could get that much approval, it'd be something. Now, as to the economic laws governing business. Of course, the strictest of honesty was required. No false measures, no false weights. You'll find that in Deuteronomy 25, verses 13 to 16, Leviticus 19, verses 35 to 36. The labor laws have their foundation in the Bible. There must be no oppression of the workmen who work for you. Servants, they're called in the Bible, and most people employed today wouldn't take kindly to the use of that word. But as used in the English of 3.5 centuries ago, one who was hired to do work for another could be classified as servant. There must be no oppression of them. Leviticus 25, verses 39 to 42 and verses 47 to 55. And wages must be paid when due. Now, in those days, wages were paid daily. The average working man didn't have enough that he could go along for a month or a week without pay. So wages had to be paid not later than sunset every day. Deuteronomy 24, verses 14 to 15. Now, on loans, no interest whatever could be charged except from aliens. To your fellow Israelite, you could not charge any interest. Now, today we say, usury, that's anything above 42% a year. As the word usury is used in your King James Version, it means a trillionth of 1% a century, or anything above it. Anything whatsoever, anything that is paid for the use of money or a thing of value, is usury in that sense. In other words, the lender must pay back to you the principal of what he borrowed, but not interest. Now, you are under no obligation to try to make the people of other races as prosperous as Israel. If they wanted to borrow from you to get some of your prosperity, it was fair enough that they pay you something for it. And you could charge interest to any non-Israelite. See Deuteronomy 23, verses 19 to 20, Leviticus 25, verses 35 to 38. Now, they had mortgages in those days, and if a person became hard up and had to mortgage the family homestead, the farm, or had to sell it, he had the right of redemption. In other words, you could not lose the farm that was the source of the family's living permanently. Now, a house within a walled city was in a little different classification. If you sold a house within a walled city, you had 1 year in which to redeem it. And if you didn't redeem it within a year, it was gone permanently. But the people within the city were not depending on that house primarily for their living. If you were a saddle maker or a silversmith or whatnot, living in town doing your work, you could move to another house someplace else and do your work just as well. But as to the farm, which was the source of the family's living, every 50th year, the Jubilee year, whatever property had been sold or taken on mortgage foreclosure, if it had not been redeemed before that, it came back to its original owner without the payment of anything. That doesn't mean 50 years from the time you sold it. It was every 50th year on the calendar. If last year was the Jubilee year, you could mortgage or sell your property this year for 50 years. If next year was the Jubilee year, you could only mortgage or sell it for the remainder of this year. When that time came, the property came back without payment of anything. You remember what happened to the Roman Empire. When they were a nation of sturdy, independent farmers, they became a powerful empire that ruled most of the known world. Then the inevitable happened. Farmers, of course, are subject to the vagaries of bad weather and insect plagues and that sort of thing. They have a bad year, get no crop, and the average farmer doesn't have enough saved up to coast over another year. So they mortgage the farm and lose it in foreclosure, or they have to sell it. They drift into town to become a landless city rabble, and there you have the fall of the Roman Empire, as you can find it in great detail in Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. That was not to happen to God's people, Israel. Every seventh year, the year of release, you were freed from the burden of unpayable debts. Now, it was the obligation of every man who was in debt to make every honest effort to pay off his debt. But it was bound to happen to many that, with all honesty and good faith, they just couldn't do it. Now, instead of being hounded forever, you know how it is today, a man owes some money, the creditor won't wait, he gets a judgment, then he levies an attachment on the man's wages, garnishment on his wages, and gets him fired from his job. And whenever he gets a new job, well, the creditor's around there to levy a garnishment on the wages and gets him fired from that job. That sort of thing couldn't be under the rules of the kingdom of God. Whatever remained unpaid after all fair and honest efforts were made to pay it, when the seventh year came around, was canceled. You got a fresh start. Now, God promised that if the nation would live up to that, the creditors would recognize the release of debts on the seventh year, that God would send such prosperity that you would not suffer any loss from not continuing to extract every penny from your debtors. It's something, of course, that just an individual here or there couldn't put into effect, probably. In other words, you are more or less the prisoner of the sort of social system you live under, an economic system. But if the nation would adopt it, we were promised prosperity, and we would have it. Then, as I say, after seven of these year of release periods, you came to the Jubilee year. Now, where you had sold your property or lost it in foreclosure, no further proceedings could be taken to try to collect a deficiency judgment after that seventh year, but the property didn't automatically go back to you on the seventh year. It was only on the Jubilee year. In the agricultural laws, you had the rules which we violate constantly and pay the penalty. One of these rules was this, that when you plant trees, you cannot wait eagerly to grab the first apple or orange or what have you that the tree can produce. For the first 3 years, you are not permitted to allow any fruit to form on the tree at all. You've got to go around and nip off every bud so that no fruit forms. The fourth year, if you wish, you are permitted to let fruit form on the tree, but none of it's for you. Every single bit of it has to be taken to the temple as an offering. The fifth year's crop and thereafter is your own. Well, now, I had a chance to see that demonstrated. Most of you, I guess, know where Escondido is, about 20 miles north of San Diego. A friend of mine bought some land there and planted it in an orange grove. And the very same year, his land and his next-door neighbors, on the same slope of the same hill, the same exposure to sunlight and the weather, the same soil, no difference except a wire fence separating the two properties. His neighbor also planted an orange grove at the very same time. And I was out there and I looked them over when the fifth year's crop was forming on the trees. Now, on the neighbor's land, the trees were not particularly big. There was a certain amount of height, but the branches were thin and spindly. There were some oranges on it, not a great many. And under every one of these little thin, spindly branches, there was a wooden prop so that the branch wouldn't be broken by the weight of these oranges. Now, my friend had obeyed God's law. For 4 years, no fruit was allowed to form, and here was his first crop, the fifth year, forming on the trees. His trees were pretty nearly double the size of his neighbor's. Thick, strong branches. His crop was considerably more than double the number of oranges, and there wasn't a prop under one of these branches, and there wasn't one needed. At the end of that fifth year, my friend would have more profit, more saleable crop than his neighbor had for the entire five. And from then on, pure velvet, because his trees were always going to be that much better than his neighbor's. Now, God doesn't bother arguing with you why you should do these things. He tells you this is the best way. Do it. If you're curious enough to look into it, you'll find out there's a good reason for it. From the time this neighbor's trees were very little bigger than weeds, he was trying to coax every possible orange off of it. And the strength of the growing plant was being too much diverted into the production of fruit and too little left for growing big, strong, sound wood. My friend followed God's law. Not a bit of the strength of that growing plant wasted on fruit. It all went into making a sturdy tree, big, strong, healthy. Then, when its proper growth period was completed, then let it bear fruit and you'll get fruit in abundance. Now, another one of these agricultural laws is that your land must get its Sabbath of rest the same as you do. 1 year and seven, the land must be allowed to lie fallow. You plant and harvest your crops for 6 years, and the next year you let it alone. And we're too greedy to do it. Now, you remember the Dust Bowl conditions of around 1932-3 in there. Well, we followed our customary greed. We were constantly planting and replanting the land, and you know in the Bible it says that if you do not follow these agricultural laws, God said, I will make the sky like brass, and your rain shall be powder and dust. And it was. They had to let the land alone or it would have blown away completely. Why the 1 year rest in seven? A plant has to get out of the soil two things. It has to get the humus, the nitrogen-bearing remains of former plant life there, and it has to get minerals. You know how much you're reading now about what they call the hidden hunger? You eat plants growing on worn-out soil, and they are lacking in vitamins, and especially they are lacking in minerals because they can't get them out of a worn-out soil. Now, a grain of sand is all mineral, and it isn't of any use to the plant because that quartz is completely insoluble in water, and the plant can't get anything but what dissolves in water. Now, there are bacteria that grow in the soil in great numbers, and as a byproduct of their existence, they produce certain acids. And these acids corrode away the surface of the sand grains, breaking them down into water-soluble salts. And therefore, those dissolve in the water, the roots of the plant draw the water out of the ground, and they get the minerals for a healthy plant. Now, you can pour on ammonium sulfate fertilizers on the land any amount you want. And sure, it's sort of a shot in the arm to the plant. It makes it green the same way green paint would, but it doesn't make it healthy. You've got to have those soluble minerals. For thousands of years, we bred our food plants for heavy yield, meaning that they feed heavily on the soil. At the end of 6 years, you have, as you might say, overdrawn your bank account of soluble minerals in the soil. Whatever reserve was there, you've used up, and you're taking it out faster than the bacteria can replace it. Now, if you will let it alone the seventh year, not grow anything, the bacteria continue working, and you've got one whole year's production of soluble mineral salts there, ready to start out with. Your bank account is replenished with a new deposit. So the eighth year, when you plant your crops, they've got one whole year's production in addition to the current year's production. They use all of the current year's production, and they draw a little bit on the 1 year's reserve that's there. And that will carry you through for 6 years. Then you start out with another year of rest. A few years ago, I saw some figures put out by someone who unquestionably knew nothing about divine law on this, but he was just recording what the statistics showed. The Agriculture Department knew, of course, exactly what the yield had been per acre on those dust bowl areas when they were planted to wheat, before the dust storms finally compelled giving the land its rest. Well, they had to leave them several years fallow, and finally they began cautiously planting some of them. And he reported this: the first year's crop they took off after this several years' rest, the yield was as high as 400% what it had been before the dust storm period started. Now, let's see what you can do by violating the laws of God. For most of our prairie states of the Midwest, we have pretty exact statistics on what the yield per acre of wheat and corn and so on has been from the time they were first put under cultivation. And you do not get as high production per acre now as you did 75 to 100 years ago. It's gone down. But let's assume that you got a steady level of production. So, you get a year's crop, we'll say, is one unit. You get one unit for each of 8 years. That's 8 units. Now suppose you follow the law of God. You get one unit for each of the first 6. Then you skip the 7th, getting nothing. And on the 8th, you get 4 units. 6 and 4 are 10. As compared to 8 if you didn't give the land its rest. We think we're too smart when we're merely too greedy to follow God's laws. But there's a good reason for all of God's laws. And if you follow them, they pay off. As to the dietary laws, I read you the one, Deuteronomy 12, verses 23 to 25, that you are not to eat fat of the meat, nor blood. Leviticus 7, verses 23 to 24, also on this. Another rule is that you are not to eat any kind of contaminated meat. Meat that has been in contact with things that might either put some sort of bacterial infection into it, or any other poisonous thing. Leviticus 7, verse 19. Now as to what meats are fit to eat. They were given the rule, you could eat the flesh of those animals which both had a cloven hoof and chew the cud. Now, a rabbit or hare chews chews the cud, but it has paws and not hoofs at all. A pig has cloven hoofs, but it does not chew the cud. Pork, rabbit, forbidden. Camel, likewise. Camel, I think, chews the cud, but it does not have hoofs. Now, cattle, cloven hoof. Sheep, cloven hoof. Deer, cloven hoof. And, yes, I'm pretty sure they also have the double stomach and chew the cud. And definitely venison was a permitted meat. Why shouldn't you eat any of these other things? Are the rules arbitrary? No. You can disregard God's law, eat pork, and get trichinosis. There are hundreds of thousands of cases of it every year in the United States. Much of it not diagnosed. You see, these are tiny little worms that, they're very small, almost microscopically small. And they work themselves all through the muscles of the meat and settle down, chew out a little hollow where they settle down, and the body sort of walls it in with a membrane around it, and there they stay. They're thriving on the nourishment carried to them by the blood. Now, you eat the meat of an infected pig. If it's not extremely well cooked, in your stomach, the meat digests. And that means these sacs around these little worms digest, setting them free. They burrow through the walls of your intestines into the blood vessels there. And they drift with the blood throughout your body, and wherever the idea occurs to them, they decide this is far enough. They burrow through the wall of the blood vessel into the muscles and set up housekeeping. Now, if some of them do this in the liver, why, you have jaundice and maybe suspected of a case of cirrhosis of the liver. And without an autopsy cutting up your liver to see, they can't be sure. They can't know whether it's trichinosis or not. If they get into the heart muscle, you've got troubles, and so on. So many of these are not diagnosed. Rabbit, they're subject to a good many diseases, such as tularemia, which is often fatal. Now, even if you cook pork well enough that you kill all these trichinosis worms in the thing, that doesn't make it a wholesome food. There's too much else wrong with it. There's a number of other diseases you can get from pork. And even if the bacteria themselves are killed, remember that what it has done to the flesh of that diseased animal, the chemical condition that is set up there, which is causing the sickness of the animal, that's what you're taking into your body. Fish, any kind of fish with fins and scales. Now, catfish, a lot of people in the South like to eat catfish. Catfish has fins, but it has no scales. It has just a skin. And the catfish is a carrion eater. It eats dead and rotting things that it finds in the water. Now, among the birds, there's a long list of forbidden birds. Of course, the vulture and buzzard and so on, carrion eaters, are forbidden. But also, in general, the carnivorous birds, the eagle, the hawk, and so on, are forbidden. As among the four-footed animals, all the carnivorous animals are forbidden. Some people like to eat bear meat, but of course, strictly forbidden. These things are unwholesome. Snails, mice, lizards. Some people will eat anything, but all these things are forbidden. Then, eat no flesh of any animal that has died of disease. Now, if you go out into the field and find the carcass of a cow that died of hoof and mouth disease, and you cut a steak off of it and take it home and eat it, you probably are not going to lose your salvation. In fact, you may wind up in heaven a lot quicker. You're going to lose your health immediately and quite probably your life. So, the whole purpose of these laws of the practical group, it does not deal with your spiritual salvation. It deals with your practical life here and now. Why then did God do more than just make suggestions? Well, he said in substance, I want a healthy nation to serve me. I don't want you filthy with trichinosis or these other diseases that you can get. Don't defile yourself with these things when you are going to be my people, my demonstration of what a nation should be. I have said that if you will obey my laws, you will have good health, long life, peace, prosperity. Now, don't you go spoiling the demonstration by making yourself sick, violating the very laws that I've given you for your guidance. So, these laws were enforced. In fact, Old Testament days, they were enforced even by the death penalty, because God wanted this nation to have a chance to show the world what obedience to his law would do. Anytime we're ready to get back on the ball and live up to the laws of God, we can get all the benefits of it.
My subject today is In Partnership with God. As those of you who listen to this broadcast know, God's people Israel of the Bible survive today in the form of the nations we roughly classify as Anglo-Saxon. From its first establishment as a nation, Israel has been selected by God himself for a most unusual honor, to work with him in establishing his kingdom on this earth. Such a partnership has never been offered to any other people. In Leviticus 20, verses 24 to 26, God said, I am Yahweh your God, which have separated you from other people, and ye shall be holy unto me. For I, Yahweh, am holy, and have severed you from other people, that ye should be mine. And in Deuteronomy 7, verse 6, For thou art an holy people unto Yahweh thy God. Yahweh thy God hath chosen thee to be a special people unto himself, above all people that are upon the face of the earth. And through the prophet Amos our God said, You only have I known of all the families of the earth. As God's partners, our task was twofold. First, to keep order among the turbulent and warlike nations, and second, to be God's witnesses of the truth of his word and the excellence of his laws, both at home and by colonizing the world all over the globe. God expressly gave us our orders as his policemen in the world. For example, Jeremiah 51, verse 20, Thou art my battle axe and weapons of war, for with thee will I break in pieces the nations, and with thee will I destroy kingdoms. Again, we know that the surviving descendants of the ancient Edomites originated present-day communism and are the leaders of communism in all nations today, where they still carry on their ancient hatred of Christianity. In Ezekiel 25, verse 14, God said, "And I will lay my vengeance upon Edom by the hand of my people Israel, and they shall do in Edom according to mine anger and according to my fury, and they shall know my vengeance, saith Yahweh God." This we've never done in all past history, so we know it is a duty that we must still perform. Today, most people join the thoughtless and ignorant in denouncing colonialism as a nasty word. But God expressly commanded us to colonize the world. For example, in Genesis 28, verse 14, he said, "Thou shalt spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south." Again, in Isaiah 54, verses 2 and 3, God said, "Enlarge the place of thy tent, and let them stretch forth the curtains of thine habitations. Spare not, lengthen thy cords, and strengthen thy stakes. For thou shalt break forth on the right hand and the left, and thy seed shall inherit the nations, and make the desolate cities to be inhabited." When we obeyed these commands, we brought peace and civilization to Africa, India, the Near East, Southeast Asia, Cuba, Indonesia, and the Philippines. Now that we have shirked our duty and abandoned these places, are the natives of Palestine and Indonesia as well off as they were under the British and the Dutch? What civilization do Cuba, Nigeria, and the Congo have now? And in our turn, by this cowardly failure to do our duty, we have gained only the hatred of most of the world. Both at home and in other lands which we colonized, we were to establish the laws of God that all the world might see a practical demonstration of the peace and prosperity that would follow. In the 43rd chapter of Isaiah, God said, "But now, thus saith Yahweh that created thee, O Jacob, and he that formed thee, O Israel, fear not, for I have redeemed thee, I have called thee by thy name, thou art mine. Ye are my witnesses, saith Yahweh, and my servant whom I have chosen, that ye may know and believe me, and understand that I am he. Before me there was no God formed, neither shall there be after me. This people have I formed for myself, they shall show forth my praise." The reward for this was to be very great. Besides the prosperity which would result from living under God's laws, we were to be greatly honored. In Exodus 19, verses 5 and 6, God said, "Now therefore, if ye will obey my voice indeed and keep my covenant, then ye shall be a peculiar treasure unto me above all people, for all the earth is mine, and ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." The strangest part of this remarkable partnership is the way the income from it was to be divided. God surely is the senior partner, yet he took only 10% as his share and gave the 90% to us, the junior partners. The rules are given first in Leviticus 27, verses 30 to 32. That a tithe, that is 10%, of all the increase or income is holy unto God. It is his share of the nation's income. Under God's kingdom, this would replace all ordinary taxes. This tithe was paid to the Levites, who made up the entire civil service, not only of the temple priesthood, but of all the civil government, and they in turn paid 10% of their share to the priests. Then for organized charity, there was another tenth every 3 years. This made up all the taxes paid in God's kingdom, 13 1/3% per year. Under our present system, just your federal income tax alone starts with over 15% on the poorest taxpayer, and instead of encouraging prosperity, it punishes the prosperous with an increasing tax running up as high as 77%. For this one tax. But that's just the beginning. On top of this, you pay a multitude of federal excise taxes, most of which you don't recognize as taxes because they just increase the price of the things you buy. Then there are your state income tax and another tax you don't recognize, the state corporation tax, which is just another expense of doing business, so the corporations just raise the price of their goods and services to cover it, and you, the individual consumer, pay them all. Then there are the state and county or city sales taxes, another 5%, and your city and county property taxes, not to mention the various city, state, and county license taxes. Over a third of our entire national income is consumed in these many taxes, over 35%, instead of the 13.3% we would pay under God's kingdom. No nation in all history has long survived after taxation passed the 30% mark, and we are already well past it, and the politicians' voracious appetite is raising taxes higher and higher. The fact that you've chosen to support Brown and Johnson, Soapy Williams and Humphrey, Ben-Gurion and Tito, Communist Premier Gomulka of Poland and Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana, this does not relieve you of your honest duty to give God his 10% share as senior partner. This 10% is his money. After all, if you expect him to work for the firm as one of the partners, isn't it right that he should receive his share of the profits? And if he doesn't get it, can you expect him to be a working partner indefinitely? He reminds us of this in Malachi 3, verses 8 to 10. Will a man rob God? Yet ye have robbed me. But ye say, wherein have we robbed thee? In tithes and offerings. Ye are cursed with a curse, for ye have robbed me, even this whole nation. Bring ye all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be meat in mine house, and prove me now herewith, saith the Lord of hosts, if I will not open you the windows of heaven, and pour you out a blessing that there shall not be room enough to receive it. When we are able to get back to the kingdom of God, which we will do when Jesus Christ returns, we will be freed of our present crushing burden of unjust taxation. We will only pay to God his share of the income and have all the rest for ourselves. Then we won't need Social Security, for we'll be able to save plenty out of our own earnings. Think what you could do if you were allowed to keep the income that is rightfully yours, but which your politicians now steal from you to give it to your enemies all over the world. But in the meantime, remember that neither you as an individual nor the nation as a whole can say, I'm in business for myself. This is all mine. You are just a junior member of a partnership whose senior partner is God. As a nation, we've failed to operate the partnership business. We have ceased to police the heathen. We have ceased to colonize and bring education and civilization to the world. And we have stolen the senior partner's share of the profits. You, as an individual, may not be able to influence national policy enough to get us back on the right track. On the other hand, how hard did you try? In any event, you as an individual can still deal honestly and fairly with your senior partner, God, for he is not only the nation's partner, he is also your partner in your own business. Why don't you take him at his word, pay God's tithe to support the work of bringing his word to the people, and see what blessings he will give you as his faithful partner. And I might suggest that a good place to start is to support this broadcast, Your Heritage.
This tape was produced by Your Heritage and Pastor Bertrand Comparé. We have much more information in written form and tape recordings, both reel and cassette. We offer this material to assist the personal ministries of those who are called to awaken Yahweh's Israel sheep to the truth of His Word and the necessity for national repentance. Feel free to call upon us for personal consultation. We welcome your suggestions as to how Your Heritage can more effectively spread the gospel of the kingdom. Many people are meeting in their homes using Pastor Comparé's material as a basis for their study. Such groups represent a healthy return to the early assemblies of believers and offers those who finally see the light and come out of the Babylonian church system a place to worship with other believers. We would hope that such meetings would also provide the nucleus of support for our radio broadcast in your area, and we shall be happy to cooperate with you in this regard. As you know, Your Heritage is not associated with any organization. As our congregation, we depend upon your tithes and offerings to pay the expenses of spreading the gospel. We try to merit your support. Please send your letters, your requests for material, and your generous contributions to Your Heritage, P.O. Box 5486, San Diego, California, ZIP 92105. Goodbye, and may the grace of Jesus Christ be with you all.